Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Hi there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of CompTIA's Shark Bites, where we explore tech leadership in government. I'm Alan Shark, Executive Director of CompTIA's Public Technology Institute, better known simply as PTI. As you may know, we present new episodes every other Thursday. And please consider subscribing wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss a topical episode. Today, we are very excited to have a conversation with City of Dallas CIO Bill Zielinski. Welcome, Bill, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alan. Appreciate your having me on.
Great. So you took the role of CIO for the City of Dallas in June 2020. But I'm interested not only in your current experience, but you've had an amazing career with nearly 30 years working for the federal government. And these are just highlights. You've been with the General Services Administration, GSA, as Assistant Commissioner for the IT category. You've also served in GSA as a Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Category Management. You've worked for the Office of Management and Budget. You were a branch chief for agency oversight. You worked for the Social Security Administration as their CIO. And you work for the Office of Personnel Management as Associate Director for Retirement Services. That's an amazing ride. So we have a lot of questions. I'm glad you're here. But I always like to start out with what got you involved in technology? You know, was there something as a child that just you gravitated towards it? What were the things that influenced you the most?
Alan, that's a great question. I'll just start with the word serendipity. As the start of it. So I actually have a degree in counseling psychology. My goal growing up was to be a counselor for children at risk. So, you know, those children who might be suffering from mental health issues or abuse issues or whatever those things might be. And that was my goal. I really wanted to help children. And I did some internships in college where I worked directly for a number of services organization and working with at-risk children. And I went home one day to my mother and I said, Mom, I don't know if I could do this. This is it, not from the standpoint of intellectually or you know the ability to understand what I need to do, but just emotionally. I would come home just a mess because, you know, these kids and the troubles that were there. I said to my mom, I don't know if I could really do this. So Alan, that you know, the thing that motivated me as a child and was directing me towards something, I very, very quickly learned that I might not have the emotional fortitude to be able to do what I was hoping to do. So I happened into this federal career working for the Social Security Administration. And interestingly enough, a computer showed up in the office one day. We had no computers in the office. We just had tap terminals or dummy terminals that connected back to a mainframe with the 3270 emulation and, you know, just really simple kind of query functions. And that computer sat in the back room for about 3 weeks. And one day I went to my boss and said, hey, I have a computer at home. And I'd be glad to set this up for us. I'm not sure why we received it or what we're supposed to be doing with it, but I'd be glad to set up this computer for you. And that was kind of the start of it. As I set up the computer, I became the person who trained everybody on how to use the simple programs that were on that computer. That kind of moved into when something was happening more at a regional level for the multi-state region. My boss, my manager in the office nominated me to become the person who would then work on the region's implementation plan for putting out the networked computers. And it all just has kind of rolled from there, Alan. And I've, you know, continued to move into these different roles. And to me, Alan, what's really exciting is technology represents the art of the possible, right? Technology represents the what if. Technology represents shaking up our known world and our known environment and utilizing that technology to establish, you know, to press the next horizon and to accomplish the next great thing. And if you combine that with my love for public service, that idea that I can have a job where I leverage and I use technology to press that next horizon and provide better services to the citizens, or to the, in my case, the residents, businesses, and visitors to the city. What a great job. Who could ask for something better than playing with technology for the betterment of people's lives? That's what really motivates me in this space, Alan.
I feel very much the same way, and I've been doing that for a long time myself. But it's interesting, you know, I looked at your background. I was wondering if you were going to mention that in terms of your degree, but I would think some of the skills that you learned way back probably are extremely helpful today. You're dealing with adults, kind of, and you're dealing with counseling. I mean, the role of the CIO has really changed. Yeah, you have to know technology, but it's really becoming, this is a people business too. You're dealing with change management. You're dealing with motivating people, understanding what makes them tick, what strings to pull at all levels. That must be something that you look back and said, you know, I never would have thought, but I can tap into some of that.
Yeah. So, Alan, I appreciate that. That's exceedingly insightful from my perspective. I will tell you that my mother over the years, right, over the last 30, 35 years has said to me, Bill, isn't it interesting that you never used, quote unquote, used your degree? And I say to my mother all the time that, oh, no, Mom, I use my degree every day. I actually can't imagine something that would be more helpful to me. And it's exactly for the reasons that you talk about, right? So while the technology is important, often the factors that help to make it either successful or unsuccessful have way more to do with those things that you mentioned, right? Being able to sit down with my business partners and help to extract what are the business outcomes that you're attempting to achieve? What are the things that you need the technology to do for you? Alan, when I first started, those of us who were in technology were kind of magicians, right? There were people who didn't even know how to use a mouse, right? And nowadays, between touch screens and the mouse and kind of the man-machine interfaces, the human interface that's there, it's so much easier to use. And everybody starts doing that at like 2 years old, right? You start with those interfaces at a very young age. But back then it was we don't really understand what you're doing, but you're magicians and just do this. The world we're in now is way more challenging as a technologist, because not only are the choices of how you implement technology and the technologies available so much more than was there before, but you also have a population who, they may not be tech savvy, but they are tech knowledgeable and they are tech aware. Mm-hmm. So they ask those questions all the time. Well, I could go down to the corner technology store and I could do X, Y, and Z, and I don't understand why this takes so long and why it doesn't. Right. So they have expectations for the use of technology and the delivery of technology. And so being able to navigate those kinds of conversations, utilizing those skills that I gained at an early age in my early development in college as a counselor are extremely helpful to me to establish that connection, to be able to help folks understand that I am listening and I do understand what they're saying. That reflective sort of listening. Yeah, you're spot on. You know, that I would tell people that out of almost anything that I've learned, those skills have been some of the most instrumental to me in my career.
And who would have thought, you know, when you look back, the backdrop to this conversation is a study that happened maybe a couple of years ago with NASCIO, the National Association of State CIOs, we work very closely with, and they did a poll of all the state CIOs talking about the next generation of CIOs, looking at rank ordering skill sets. And surprising to many was a technology or technologist was number 9 out of 10. It was, you know, a deal maker. It was an economic development person. Okay. It was business minded, team builder, you know, deal maker, all the things we have to do in addition to being a technologist. So it is an interesting aspect of the changing nature of the CIO. But let's go back a little bit. You know, you spent just about 30 years in the federal government, all in high level management. The agencies I mentioned are all dealing with tremendous issues, procurement, use of technology. And so what was a transition like? What motivated you to leave the comforts of these great agencies in which you were doing fantastic to going to certainly a great city. Dallas has been one of PTI's members for many, many years. But what was that? First of all, two questions. What was the transition like from a federal bureaucracy that you were very accustomed to Dallas? And we could talk about some of the things about Dallas, but let's start with the bureaucracy and that shift, first of all. And what motivated you to actually leave the federal government?
Yes. I ask myself that question often, Alan. So 30 years, I was coming up on my 30th anniversary, and I actually did. I left the feds just after my 30th anniversary. I think officially it's like 30 years in 1 month.
Okay.
And as I was approaching that milestone, you know, there's a lot of things that are kind of associated with that milestone. And in the federal retirement system, you know, 30 years is a good mark. I don't have the age to retire, but 30 years is kind of that, you know, full unreduced retirement benefit kind of piece to it. And as you've pointed out, I've moved in and between a number of different agencies. And I'll tell you what motivates me in terms of that movement is the what's next. I really like parachuting into challenges. I like running to the fire. I like those places where somebody tells me, well, you know, Bill, we think you could do this extremely well, and we think you could be very helpful to us, and these skills and these experiences that you have accumulated, we think you could really bring to bear in this next position. So I've been fortunate to have many instances in which I've been recruited towards these positions, that people were interested in me coming to those positions. But when I've talked to them about what those positions held and what was there, there have been instances where there weren't challenges to be faced. It wasn't a new horizon. It wasn't something, some sticky sets of problems that I had to solve. And I've said no to opportunities that I didn't feel like were ones where I could go in and make a difference and really help improve the state of operations. And Alan, I always think that when I get into one of these positions, my main goal is to work myself out of a job. And what I mean by that is I have done my job well if at some point during my tenure, if I were to say, hey, I've decided to move on to here, that people, the people of the organization and the leadership of the organization might say, oh no, Bill, we're sad to see you leave. Can't we convince you to stay? But we also know that at the end of the day, that if you do leave, you've left us in a good position strategically, operationally, administratively, so that we can carry on, right? I never want to find myself in a position where people are saying that they're dependent, you know, that we can't do this without you. I'd much rather have people say that, yeah, you know, we don't want you to leave and we'll miss you, but we actually feel pretty good that we can continue to thrive and build from what you've done. So Alan, always approach every single job in that way. What's the challenge? What do you need me to attack? How do I need to pick something? And as I go through 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever my time is in those positions, can I put myself in a position to where they're like, well, we don't want you to leave, but if you do, you have, you know, we want to thank you for what you've done and what you've left behind, because we can carry forward and build upon those successes. So that's number one. Number two, when I talk about coming to the city itself, I'll tell you what was missing. So in that 30-year career in the Fed, in those very, very senior positions, I was IT operations as a CIO. I was IT acquisition, you know, talking about pushing $30 billion worth of annual sales through contracts for federal aid, you know, hundreds of federal, state, and local departments, having a broad impact from a IT acquisition perspective, IT policy with the Office of Management and Budget, working with Congress as laws were passed to then turn that into policy that could be followed, regulation and policy that could then be followed. I enjoyed moving in and between those things, but I'll tell you what was kind of missing is that you're fairly distant, right? You can understand the impact that you're having in each of those roles, but you're a little bit more distant from seeing the impact that you're having directly on the lives of the people that you're serving. And so coming to the city was really this opportunity for me to return to a role where I can see that direct impact that I'm having, negatively or positively, right? Because it's not always sunshine, light, and unicorns, right? There's sometimes bad things that happen, but that impact that you're having and knowing and understanding that when you have successfully implemented a program or you've rolled out some technology or you've put defenses in place that's protect us from attacks, whatever those things might be, being able to see much more directly who you're impacting. That was really the largest driver for me, Alan, in returning to IT operations and doing so in a context or a location where you could see that impact in a much more direct way than you did in a federal agency.
So note to the audience who are listening to this, who are not seeing Bill as I am on a video feed right now. When you hear someone say that they've spent 30 years in government, Bill is still quite younger than you may imagine. So you started very, very young. And I just want to make it clear that you have a ways to go. You are in the infancy in many ways. And it's unusual to have somebody with that many years and experience behind you. So let's move ahead a little bit. You use the word you like to parachute in somewhere and solve problems. Well, you picked one heck of a time. So here it is, June, and you probably had made the arrangements well before then to arrive in Dallas as their CIO in 2020. As we look at our calendars, well, we started to hear something called a pandemic in March, April, May. You really went into the fires, short of going to California, in Dallas. Now suddenly you are in the midst of a pandemic. The city is pivoting to a mobile workforce. Tell us what that was like. What did you inherit at that moment in time? Because you were there as part of a transition too.
Absolutely, Alan. And I actually interviewed, the final interview for the job was back in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. It was on Wednesday, March 11th. And what was interesting is that day was the first case in the city of Dallas was confirmed. And so I went to the interview on that day. Everybody was just starting to adjust. You know, we did elbow bumps or fist bumps, and, you know, we're not going to shake hands, we're not going to do these things. And everyone was really confused because that first reaction was, let's shake hands with the potential candidates. And so it really was a little bit surreal and strange. And I went back to my office at GSA on Thursday, March 12th. And then I teleworked on Friday the 13th, but that was the day that the federal government said, okay, for those DC workers, unless it's a essential position where you must be at a physical location because the natures of your duties are such, then you all go home and stay home until we tell you otherwise, right? So it was right at that time when I was interviewing for the position. I started my tenure with the city of Dallas working from my home in Maryland. The city of Dallas at that time really didn't have telework. They didn't have remote work. They were not used to deploying or provisioning their new employees with equipment. It was perhaps a little bit easier with me because I actually at some point in my career have been IT support and help desk support. So you at least had somebody who knew how to kind of get myself set up and configure things. You didn't have other users, right? So that piece of it was fine, but I will tell you there was a few months in there where it was kind of like, well, I need to go out to Dallas and figure out where I'm going to live and you know where my family is going to settle and those sorts of things. At the same time, all of my kids were in college at this. They were spread in New York State, in Arizona, in the Seattle area, in three different schools, and so it was a really bizarre kind of window of time. So I came out to Dallas at the end of August, and I'll tell you, we're now here more than a year later from the day that I first set foot in the building, and I still haven't personally met, I want to say, three quarters of the folks in the IT organization I've never seen in person. And I have town hall meetings, and I set up individual meetings to try to establish that rapport. But Alan, that piece where part of your getting to know, and for me personally, part of getting to know that organization is those times in between meetings when I wander out into the halls and I stop at the water cooler, or I just drop by somebody's desk and say, hey, I want to thank you for that note that you sent me, or that opportunity to establish a personal rapport or a personal contact. That's been one of the most difficult things. From a technology deployment standpoint, we had to do a hard left turn, and I was coming in right at the height of that hard left turn. City Council is a big part of how we operate from a governmental perspective, right? And City Council meetings all had to turn to virtual City Council meetings. We now had to increase our security for at-home workers. We now had to provision them with devices that had cameras, and we now, right, all these things were the focus. Internally, provisioning was we're not set up to do remote work and work from home. We now have to do that quickly. All that stuff from a change management perspective that usually accompanies those sorts of things was out the door. In some ways, I kind of like the idea that you know, don't let a good emergency go to waste, because in past times, trying to get some of these initiatives through, it was less about the technology deployment or the technology itself. It was about that human factor and getting people able to pivot. Boy, man, convincing people to use digital signatures is a lot easier in a pandemic, right? Convincing people that we have to do it this way because you can't come into the building and stick stuff in a manila folder and pass it around for a wet signature. Man, you cut right through some of that change management perspective. But then there was also a number of things that we experienced in terms of external services or those to the citizens and having to tune our applications, because now we had people who were used to coming into a physical location and meeting one of the city's employees to be able to work on something. They were now having to do some amount of self-help. People, the city employees, were having to come in externally as well. And our applications weren't necessarily tuned, right? They were tuned for a different type of interaction. So yeah, Alan, you're absolutely right. That pivot and joining during the middle of a pandemic, you know, for somebody who likes to run to the fire, it was not the fire I was expecting. But you just have to persevere and keep tracking. You know, at the same time, we're doing these things that are must-dos in the short term. You also can't lose sight of what are the things that we need to be doing in the long term. Because at some point, whether the pandemic fully goes away or not, you need to normalize your operations, right? So you have that immediate reaction to the pandemic. You have that we now have to start provisioning things because it appears to be lasting a little bit longer. And then you move into a third phase, which is, okay, long-term operations, what does that look like? And we're now, you know, clearly in that stage of kind of normalization, even as we still don't know what's going to happen with the pandemic. But where we've settled in is we have to plan for the idea that we will have a hybridized work environment from here on out. Even if we start to bring people back in, either because this is actually good to work in this hybridized environment, or because there might be future events, we need to maintain this view that we need to have this ultimate flexibility and ultimate ability to be able to move into and out of these different contexts and still be able to do our work.
I agree. And, you know, I would use the word resilience, you know, is moving forward, the ability to withstand the what ifs of any kind, whether it be weather, health, whatever kinds of actions. I want to ask, as we kind of all explore what normal looks like, and we don't know, and you've said as much, we can guess. I think a hybrid environment is important, although we're hearing some grumblings from a number of tech folks across the country that a number of senior managers are trying to revert back to, you must be in the office and no more work at home. And this has kind of caused some heartburn among many. And we're hearing something for the first time, and that's called IT burnout, because people were maintaining help desks and dealing with kind of issues they never had to deal with before. We're helping people remotely figure out their modem settings and their cyber settings, their security settings, helping citizens even get online for town hall meetings that were being held virtually. So they've been called to work all sorts of different hours with different chores. Change for some are unsettling, for others they embrace it. but we're hearing IT burnout, and we're seeing a lot of people actually retiring or saying, if I can't have flexible hours, I'm leaving. Are you seeing that unrest with your staff?
To some degree, Alan, I think a lot of my folks and a lot of what I'm seeing is that people are enjoying, right, not having to do the commutes, right? So it's some of those little things that revolve around it that I don't have to commute, an hour, 45 minutes, whatever it might be in each direction, is actually a big boon. The idea that I have that flexibility in maintaining or managing that work schedule is a good thing. On the other side of it, I've had to be very careful about not putting pressure on folks outside of that window, right? I have this benefit of having my own office in my home that's dedicated to me and to my work. And I'm not, out in the living room or in my bedroom or some other place in the home. So I'm very fortunate from that standpoint. So I really can get up and leave the room, but I'll tell you, it's hard to create that separation or that boundary between when does work start and when does work end. I'm in a position that is by nature 24/7, 365 anyway, but those times where you're really outside of the window of normal operating hours should be seen as the exception and not the norm. And it would be very easy, it can be very easy for me to be shooting off messages at all times of the night, but there are times where I try to be very careful about taking those messages and storing them in my outbox or setting them on a timer, because I know my folks will respond to them, whether it's 2 a.m. on a Tuesday or it's the noon on a Saturday or Sunday. So those are things that I have to be very careful about in setting those boundaries and making sure that people are not participating in their own burnout. Because understand, when you commute, there's a real clear boundary that you do. I get into my work clothes, I get into my car, I drive down the road. That driving down the road or getting on public transportation is a transition time. Then I start my work, I come back, I'm now back into my home life. And that's been something that I think is a lot more difficult to see happen as well. I do think out of necessity, we've had to take a look at, what are those shifts and what are those expectations from a work perspective. But I will say overall for us, I see burnout from, we're in a pandemic, everybody has to work extra hard. Well, we're a year and a half into it. Right, we need to get back to some level of normalization, and have to declare that while the emergency may not be over, we can expect people to work at this pace and at the number of hours, with the reason being because we're in a pandemic. We have to figure out how to normalize, because you'll see a lot more of that burnout if we.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So as we wind down, we could go on for hours talking with you, Bill. It's so delightful. What emerging tech, and we've talked about people, we've talked about different kinds. What emerging tech excites you the most as you look ahead?
So, Alan, I thought you said you wanted to bring this to a close, because if you bring this conversation up to me, man, I could just quadruple the length of this. Here's what I will say. That's so exciting about being in the city context and talking about emerging tech. We have several things that are all happening kind of at the same time in the space of IT. That first one is, as we talk about 5G and 6G and the future generations of network technology, I think and solving the digital divide and understanding the criticality of everybody having access to high speed, low cost internet, right? I think we're really just at the front end of seeing the understanding and the realization, and you see it in federal legislation and other places, is there's a realization that the network has to be ubiquitous, it has to be speedy, it has to be able to handle volumes of transactions, and it has to be available to everyone in every location, right? So it becomes like the air we breathe. And I think we're going to get there. But what that sets up is this idea of IoT, sensors, cameras, monitors, things that are out there at the edge, creating incredible streams of data like we've never seen them before. So now you have these ultra present, ultra fast, ultra powerful networks that are enabling all of this data to flow at speeds and volumes like we've never seen before, combined with the sciences around the utilization of data to purpose, the data sciences where we talk about things like artificial intelligence, all combining in this context of a city geography. And traditionally, most cities have operated under a model of people having to bring themselves to a location to avail themselves of the services that are available to them in the city or to request those. We're going to see this shift to where it becomes the proactive delivery of city services to the residents and the businesses and the visitors in the city where they live. Because of this landscape, because of this combination of ubiquitous, powerful network, IoT, artificial intelligence at the edge, to where, you know, we've heard about some of these things, you know, traffic control systems that are more proactive in changing the flows. So you move away from just timers, gunshot detection. All of these types of services are going to be enabled on this platform. The challenge is going to be getting to that point where we have the ubiquity of the network. We've got to change this view that the internet is for the privileged few who can afford it. And in a city like Dallas, where it's a very diverse population, we have gaps, right? The availability of broadband and internet in the south of Dallas is not as robust and readily available as it is in the north of Dallas. We've got to fix that because we can't deliver these kind of, when we talk about digital equity, it's more than just the access to the internet. It's access to all these services that I just mentioned.
Yeah.
So we've got to fix that part of it. For us to be able to deliver it as a city, it's got to be affordable. But once you get all those things tackled, wow, from an emerging technology perspective, to switch from passive services to proactive services, utilizing this technology and the network that's there out in those locations where people live. Wow, this is just fascinating and powerful. So as you can see, Alan, I could go on for this. I will stop. I will hold myself back.
And so could I. Maybe we have to have a part two in a month or two to kind of just talk about emerging tech. I mean, one of the things that you talk about, this proactive ubiquitous network, is the ability for all these different agencies, especially in social services, to have common access to databases. People think that's already happening and it's not. If someone's going in for something and they're going to jail, it would be helpful to know if someone on the counseling side said, oh, I know about that individual, or, you know, all these different aspects of somebody in terms of how we could better help our citizens. That's just one small example. Bill, we are out of time, but I would love to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely, thank you. Again, I appreciate your having me on and giving me this chance to really talk about kind of the great work we can and should be doing in our city.
Let's check back a number of months from now and see where we are. And remember, for those listening, please consider to subscribing to CompTIA Shark Bites. Until next time, be safe physically and digitally. Till next time.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.